You're going to dance thing? For what? Really? You're working with Dr. Demetis? Spiro Demetis?
I interviewed with him.
Who's one of my residents?
Right here.
And the guy who's chief of medicine at Kings County is a critical care doc. Ghassan Jamaluddin was one of my residents. Long time ago. Anyhow, that's not part of the lecture. Okay. So, your chief residents picked this topic, and it just happened to be something that I like to talk about. It's mainly historical. It's not going to help you very much, but it'll give you a bit of insight into some of the thinking that's gone on over time. So let's start with a little history of critical care. So the first attempt at CPR is attributed to a Roman guy named Paracelsus in the year 1530. Unfortunately, it didn't work. Not too different from a lot of CPR now. And then the physician Vesalius described putting a tube in and artificially ventilating animals in the 1500s. In the 1600s, Sir William Harvey and others figured out that there was a closed circulatory system and also figured out that cardiac contractility and breathing were separate functions. But it wasn't until about 1880 that people thought about external cardiac compression. Then, in the early part of the last century, it was thought that the brain could only tolerate about 3 minutes of interruption in blood flow, but in isolated cases in children, particularly children who were chilled by drowning in cold, fresh water, they were able to be resuscitated with restoration of brain function several hours after immersion. So that's led to some of the more recent work on hypothermia and a bunch of other things were tried for brain resuscitation, including a barbiturate coma and stuff like that, but it seems that what emerged out of at least thinking about preserving the nervous system led to recent stuff with the use of hypothermia protocols. So this is an engraving, and it's about earliest CPR. You see the person in the lateral decubitus position. But what's wrong with this picture? Right. So that's probably not the best way to perform artificial ventilation. but it is a historical engraving, and not 100% sure that I'd recommend this at the next RRT. Yes. It's a very narrow tube, though, so that reverse flow is probably limited. Okay. So, going back to the Crimean War with the British forces in Crimea, which is, in what used to be the Soviet Union, Florence Nightingale, the famous nurse, wanted a separate recovery area for patients from surgery. And the first ICU in the United States was at Hopkins. It was a 3-bed neurosurgical ICU. There was a NICU established in Chicago in the 1920s, and then shock wards for resuscitation during World War II, operative recovery rooms, which is sort of intensive care units, happened by the 1960s. In the 1940s, late 1940s, there was a pandemic of polio with respiratory failure due to respiratory muscle paralysis, and the breakthrough at that point was with mechanical ventilation to sustain people through. And most of the mechanical ventilation was using external negative pressure ventilation rather than intubation and positive pressure ventilation. So patients were kept in Emerson drinker type respirations, so-called iron lungs, where everything except the head and neck were inside a large container made out of steel in which a bellows device was able to evacuate the pressure in there and cause the chest to expand. And if people had chest wall rigidity, you could also create positive pressure to force expiration. We had these at Montefiore. We had one for people with post-polio when I was a pulmonary fellow in ancient history. And the nice thing about them is when there's a power failure, there's a treadle and a lever, and you can just stand there for 14 hours, as I once did, ventilating a patient until the electricity comes back. In Denmark during the polio epidemic in the late 1940s was the first endotracheal intubation. Mechanical ventilation with positive pressure breathing was started in the 1950s, and then they figured out, rather than having people scattered around the hospital on ventilators, that it was more useful to cluster them in a respiratory type care unit. By around 1960, most hospitals that were bigger than 300 beds had an ICU. And in 1970, just 40 years ago, the Society of Critical Care Medicine got together and had its first meeting. And then in 1986, certification in critical care became available for the people who were doing it anyhow. And at the beginning of critical care, if you had been working in critical care, and particularly if you had done pulmonary medicine fellowship, you were allowed to sit to take the critical care boards. And that was the first exam, by the way, that led to the 10-year cycle of continuous maintenance of certification. So it's fun to keep taking it over and over again. I've taken it 3 times. I'm done now. But yes, you will all live with maintenance of certification as you go forward. You guys just took it last year, right?
That's right.
So it's time to start recertifying.
That's what I'm worried about, that it seems to practice.
Okay.
All right. So what happened since 1990 is that lots of diseases like brain surgery, lung cancer surgery, complicated surgery, transplantation, all of those have benefited from the use of ICUs and remote monitoring, which allows somebody supposedly to be watching what's happening with patients who have physiologic monitoring going on. That's also been an advance. And by the end of the 1990s, there were about 5,000 intensive care units in the United States. So that's sort of the beginnings, the recent stuff. What have been the issues? This is just what the ICU looks at, like in San Francisco at UCSF. It's pretty much like any ICU. So just wanted to touch on what the recent and current controversies are. So catheter-related bloodstream infections, ventilator-associated pneumonia, what should we do with glycemic control, tight control, not tight control, what kind of mechanical ventilation strategy is best. There's all sorts of modes that you can dial in on the ventilator, but is there any evidence that's one better than the other? I know what they like here, PCIRV, APRV. Well, there's no evidence that that does anything compared to any other mode, but people still like to use it. What about broad spectrum antibiotics? When do you start antibiotics with VAP, and how do you know it's VAP? There's a lot of controversy about that. There's even controversy in the hospital here between the medical staff and the epidemiology and infection control people in terms of what the definition is.
Is early goal directed therapy for sepsis useful, or is it hocus pocus? There's been some concern about it based on some of the ethical issues that were uncovered with Dr. Rivers' study of EGBT. So we'll talk about that. And the Swine-Ganz catheter that I grew up with has sort of vanished from the face of the earth because we probably don't need it. So probably 225,000 deaths a year in the United States from sepsis, about 750,000 cases. And you know all about signs of septic shock. I don't have to go through that. So there are three definitions. Everybody's familiar with the difference between sepsis, severe sepsis, and septic shock, yes? Yes, okay, good. And definitions for systemic inflammatory response syndrome. Everybody know these? Yes, okay. All right. Okay, treatments, ventilation, antibiotics, IV fluids, cut out the infection, and Zygris. How much Zygris is used at this hospital? Big zero. So some places are Zygris fans, recombinant and activated human protein C, some places are not. I could tell you when I was at North Shore LIJ, it was used probably six times a month at North Shore and not in 10 years at LIJ. So when Kim Moy goes there, she'll have to change hats depending on which campus she's on. The study showed a marginal benefit of Zygris versus a non-marginal cost.
$100,000. So the attending has to...
I think it's actually, depending on the dosing scheme, it's really between 27 and 40,000.
Okay.
But, you know, if we think it's 100,000, we're less likely. So, Rivers et al. Reported in 2001 in the New England Journal, early goal directed therapy for sepsis, which has begun in the emergency department. With volume resuscitation, measurement of central venous pressure, and also central venous oxygen concentration. The issue with the study was they developed a very special catheter for measuring central venous oxygenation, a continuous indwelling catheter. And Dr. Rivers was the consultant and held a patent on the catheter and received hundreds of thousands of dollars of money for the development of the catheter, which is part of the protocol that was published in the study. So, the hypothesis was accepted without debate. Mitch Fink, who was the chief of critical care at Pittsburgh, said, and there was questions about the rigor of the study. One of the residents involved in the study sort of went public and ratted out selection bias in that who was included in the study was really not determined up front, but determined a little bit later on. Be that as it may, the philosophy of it is that it should make sense, the volume resuscitation and maintenance of oxygenation. But 263 patients were analyzed, but 288 were evaluated. So 25 people were opted out by the investigators, and that 25 people would have possibly been able to make the difference between statistical significance between standard therapy and not. So that's the questions with the study. sudden cardiac death. What's wrong with this picture? Nobody's doing anything, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody's calling 911.
What?
Somebody's calling 911.
Yes, and there are multiple people pointing at him, right? Maybe it was an elected official. Okay, so what about the current status of CPR, mouth-to-mouth, or compressions only? Those of you who took what, recent ACLS?
Well, now with compressions, it's
Yes. Supposed to this year they're saying they're still teaching the math. Mm-hmm. They're saying that
compressions only, right? But
I would foster the nerves.
Hmm?
I would foster the nerves.
Yes. Yeah. Otherwise, it's 100-2, right? Okay, so the data came from CERC in 2008, and basically the references up there, I can leave this up on the thing if anybody wants these references, but non-trained bystander and a bystander should just provide hands-only CPR, which has class 2 evidence, and if there is somebody trained, then they can do 30-2, otherwise it's 100 compressions a minute. Okay, this is the U.S. Army teaching resuscitation in Afghanistan. Just so you know that we're participating in spreading the discipline of CPR outside the continental U.S. And after resuscitation, the big chill. So these are the first attempts at hypothermia with a bathtub and a bunch of electrodes going in and somebody on an anesthesia machine being basically packed in ice. I don't think we do it that way anymore.
We do it sometimes.
Yeah?
When the fancy things are broken.
Hmm?
Ice? Yeah, we use one ice.
Okay. So therapeutic hypothermia is, variable. Not every place has a protocol for it. But many counties and many states in Canada all have adopted therapeutic hypothermia. And this is a good little card. If you guys want this printed out, I'll email it to Eric and he can send it around. It's a good little pocket protocol card from North Carolina about how they do the protocol.
They have a line. This is basically a refrigerator.
Cool,
right? What it does is that it cools normal saline down to a certain temperature, and the catheter has a tubing around the catheter, so the saline circulates around the catheter. So it never enters the body, but it transmits the the coldness to the blood.
Right.
And it's like a $40,000.
So did they do any lab tests before they put that in?
They do the basic labs.
Did they send blood to the blood bank and check for COVID lutenins?
No.
And cryoglobulins?
No.
Okay. So there's a potential problem with that, and that would be diffuse hemolysis and intravascular coagulation. Okay. You all know the central line bundle. Hand hygiene, catheter site selection. We've moved from povidone iodine now to chlorhexidine solutions, using chlorhexidine oral prophylaxis in intubated patients. And there's recent data from Emory about taking ICU patients and giving them a daily total body chlorhexidine bath. To prevent catheter-related bloodstream infection with special sponges that are previously impregnated with chlorhexidine so that they can get sponge bath from head to toe. What about intensive insulin therapy? What's the status of that now? Up, down, down, right? Right. So the original study from Belgium suggested a significant decrease in surgical ICU mortality from like 8.5% to 4%. But then lots and lots of reports came out subsequent to that from Vancouver, the Nice Sugar Study in 2009, and basically increased mortality in patients in the ICU. And if you targeted 180, it was lower mortality than if you targeted 80 to 108. So people abandon the intensive glycemic control. Okay, ventilator-associated pneumonia bundles. If you look here, the VAP rate is the blue line going up and down. This is the standard rate. And as the percentage of applying the VAP bundle goes up, the VAP rate seems to go down, assuming we all agree on a definition of VAP. So the key things are sedation, vacations, elevation of the head of the bed, DVT prophylaxis, and probably oral hygiene or oral decontamination therapy. Not yet level one evidence, but trending in that direction. ARTSnet, you're all familiar with ARTSnet. So basically, the outcome of ARTSnet, the main outcome, is that low tidal volume ventilation decreases barotrauma and improves survival. But there was no trend of any kind in ARTSnet to prefer one ventilatory mode over the other. So APRV or PCIRV or IMV or SIMV or QRS or whatever it is, didn't really pan out as being different. There is an APRV study going on now, but the results are not out yet. Oxygenation goal basically would be around 88 to 90% with permissive hypercapnia in people with severe hypoxemic respiratory failure. pH goal around 7.3. And an IE ratio goal is that the duration of inspiration should be shorter than expiration, but no specific other recommendation. And weaning, spontaneous breathing trials daily, and no neuromuscular blocking agents. Okay, so basically 6 versus 12. Conferred a survival advantage of 22% in ARTSnet. You guys all know all this stuff, right?
Sorry?
I said everybody's been through this stuff before. Okay, so the ARTSnet study didn't define the limits to which tidal volume reduction would benefit, so can you do less than 6 mils per kilogram? Probably not in an adult. There's no data about apneic oxygenation yet, although apneic oxygenation is done during cardiac surgery all the time. You know, you can put a central venous oxygenation catheter in the inferior vena cava and have somebody apneic and extract CO2 with a scrubber. So it is possible. Electrocardiographic monitoring. We went from surface monitoring to central monitoring, back to surface monitoring. This is the original electrocardiogram, basically with a photographic system. To take a picture, you had to have an arm and a leg and an electrolyte solution. You had to be sitting upright, etc. When I was a resident, they had the last of the machines where you got a negative and you actually had to develop it to read it. That sort of died in the early 1970s. Swan-Ganz catheterization, still done occasionally, particularly in the evaluation of patients with pulmonary hypertension and protocols to see if they have vasoreactivity using a variety of drugs. But for a period of time, Swan-Ganz catheters were placed pretty much ad lib in most patients in the ICU in whom you were worried about volume resuscitation. Is it left-sided heart failure or not? What's the wedge? And now with advanced bedside echocardiography, probably really not necessary and certainly nowhere near as safe. So as of 2004, it was less than 2 per 1,000 medical admissions, and it was most prominent with people reduced in MI use and less in surgical patients. So basically, except for situations where somebody really needs data from a right heart cath, you're probably not going to see people putting in swans anymore. Ultrasound in the ICU, you're all familiar with this, for central line placement, for pleural effusions, for cardiac function, for preventing complications of central catheterization. And then there are standards that came out last February of 2009 by Paul Mayo from LIJ. In terms of what you should be able to do as a pulmonary critical care doc in the ICU, in terms of looking for pericardial infusion, looking at inferior vena cava fluctuation in size and dilatation, cardiac chamber function, etc. And then right after that, there was a statement on competence in the journal Chest, also in 2009 in the spring, defining the standards that allow you to become certified in critical care bedside echo. And there are modules, and you can get progressive competencies just like the cardiologists do with the regular echo boards. Transfusion approach, we used to transfuse to specific hematocrit. Then the immunosuppressive aspects of blood transfusion and the complications associated with it became important. And the question is, by improving oxygen delivery, are we really doing anything for patients with sepsis? And basically, the Cochrane database reviews suggest, except for people with ischemic heart disease at the time of entry into the study where oxygen carrying capacity is really critical, there's a trend to worse outcomes in people who get transfused except for ischemic heart disease. And this is from New England Journal about 10 years ago, looking at restrictive transfusion versus liberal transfusion in terms of survival. And this is P of 0.11, it's not significant, but the lines are clearly diverging at 1 month in terms of survival. So there's a trend towards better ICU survival independent of diagnosis if you're transfused less. This is from Canada, and this is basically adverse reactions per 100,000 units of blood and episodes of transfusion-associated lung injury, and basically anaphylaxis is up there as a major thing. All the others are less common, but the Canadians are very, very restrictive about the use of blood in the ICUs. This is a study from a hospital in the Atlantic provinces, which basically looked at gastrointestinal bleeding. And it showed, actually, that rebleeding was provoked by transfusion. And that if you percentage of patients with rebleeding and transfused between the non-transfused group had a statistically significant difference. So, Dr. Gleedman, who was the chair of surgery at Montefiore and here for many, many years, would, from his grave, would be happy to hear it because his motto was all bleeding stops. So what's the future of critical care? This is, you know, a military picture with critical care being administered at the battlefield. with automated critical care systems. The military already has robotic vehicles with capsules in them in which the person can be intubated, ventilated, transfused, and have volume resuscitation in a moving vehicle without any other humans in it, which they've perfected with robotic techniques and somebody in a remote control room.
Right.
But then they get evacuated. So it's called automated critical care life support. It's a self-contained system with monitoring markers of deterioration, closed-loop control of life support equipment, and the sensors measure oxygenation, adjust the FiO2 and volume automatically, and change fluid based upon measurements of blood pressure, skin turgor, and pulse volume. So, coming to your ICU soon. The other thing that you may not be familiar with is the effect of the vagal immune circuit on sepsis, which is probably the only thing new. And this was really supposed to be a little overview review, but there's evidence now that there's active communication between the central nervous system and the immune system, the peripheral immune system, particularly macrophages and monocytes, and that macrophages have cholinergic receptors on them that upregulate or downregulate cytokine release. And the guy who's done most of this work is a guy named Kevin Tracy, who's found these alpha-7 nicotinic receptors on cytokine-producing cells, and acetylcholine, driven by vagal stimulation, can suppress inflammation and decrease the cytokine storm, particularly in models of SIRS. And what his group has shown, obviously, is if you pace the vagal nerve in animal models of sepsis, you can inhibit the evolution of the negative aspects of the inflammatory response, shut off interleukin 1, etc., or use nicotine agonists to do the same thing at the central level. And if you block peripheral muscarinic receptors, you can't abolish anti-inflammatory signaling through the vagus nerve. So basically what that means is that peripheral nicotinic receptors are not required for cytokine regulation by the vagal pathway. And that also is associated with vagal control in the microvasculature, which can diminish fibrinolysis and decrease inflammation and decrease exudation of fluid in the lung. The other molecule that's important in the peripheral circulation is nitric oxide, obviously, and there's probably sufficient evidence to use exogenous nitric oxide in the peripheral circulation in some models of sepsis. So that's probably coming up soon. And really, that's about it. I just wanted to really quickly go over some of the history and the newer things. One of the things that is probably down the line a bit is to do pharmacogenomic tailoring of therapeutic agents in the ICU by doing quick gene-ship analysis to see what classes of drugs an individual will respond to and what classes of drugs an individual will have toxicity for the same diagnosis, and that's probably 5 or 10 years down the line. There's some evidence that variation in the IL-6 gene is a survival benefit, and if you would know that in advance, you could target therapy based upon that genetic variation. So major challenges for workforce in critical care and limited institutional resources, just the mess in Haiti with the recent earthquake and now the cholera epidemic. So Angus, who's one of the major proponents of critical care, lists the issues here as getting a workforce, delivering it to the right patients, moving biology from the laboratory to the bedside, etc. If we look at critical care sensitive conditions, basically probably 400,000 of them are critical care sensitive in the United States. If we look at the costs of these various things, the major cost for growth costs of it for prescription drugs, and as we get better and better biological agents, that's likely to continue to grow. Physician costs and hospital costs have been pretty flat. It's really medication costs that have gone up in terms of limiting it. What about rationing critical care beds? Oh, you guys all know about that. Everybody who's SMR is basically a critical care bed rationer. So I don't have to tell you about that. And for those of you heading into critical care careers, there's probably jobs out there, because there's an estimate that there are 4,000 too few critical care physicians in the United States. So when you finish in Brooklyn, I think you will not be joining the ranks of the unemployed. Defining goals of care and medical ethics and palliative care, obviously also critical to making ICUs more effectively used. And I'll stop there. Thanks for listening. I'm not sure that this is what you wanted, but it sort of went over the field pretty quick. How do I do that? Can I move it? Can I move it from the desktop?
That was sort of a different kind of a new concept.
It was not, I mean, it was cool.